Noreen is a human rights lawyer and a former director of Free Legal Advice Centre, member of the Commission of Future Policing and Board of Immigrant Council. There are lots of things to talk about. Hello, Noreen. Good morning.
Hello.
And you're very welcome to Lifeline.
Thank you very much, Lakshmi. Delighted to be talking to you this morning.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to have you. We were talking about before, I was doing some research and found that there is more about house party rapes and sexual assaults now are being reported to your center.
Yeah, so this was one of the things that we have identified as a trend that is starting to appear in our work.
Yes.
So we collect details every year of people who contact the National 24-Hour Helpline, which we run. Over 1,000 people contact that every month, either through the phone or through email.
Yes.
Many of them looking for support, many of them looking for information. And in addition to that, we saw in last year, or in 2017, the figures show that we saw over 500 people. And out of that, we gather statistics to try and assess who is coming to, who needs our service, who's coming to the centre, and what the issues are that they're bringing in with them. And we've seen a couple of things develop. Like, there was a while in our work where a lot of the people who were coming to us were adults who had been victims of childhood sexual abuse. Yes, those people are still coming, but more and more the people who are coming to us are disclosing rape and sexual abuse that they suffered as adults. And within that, one of the things that we noticed was that date rape and rape at house parties was becoming a feature.
Mm. So you think these people, actually those who never came and to the centre or sought any help, have been keeping it quiet?
So we think people are more inclined to speak about things. Honestly, I'm in this job almost 3 years now, and I myself have seen a huge change in the way society is prepared to talk about those who are victims of rape and sexual abuse, to recognize that it is a serious harm, and to say that something needs to be done about it. And one of the big concerns that we're also seeing develop over the last number of years is how young people are coping with the world that they live in today, a world where dating is very fast, where Tinder and other date apps really make for very, very fast decisions in relation to the beginning of sexual relationships, or which allow dating, which doesn't allow a relationship to develop at all. And we're also seeing where, in a sense, people are in some ways maybe more at ease with boys and girls being friends, with young people having non-sexual relationships with each other. And going back to that business of the house parties and the rest of it, where people are drinking maybe more at home, parties are more at home, and or in someone's house. And then people are suffering sexual abuse up to and including rape when they go to bed, just to go to sleep, and somebody assaults them, attacks them.
Yes. I mean, for instance, parents now are quite liberal. Some parents who are liberal, they let their children have parties in their houses, and they probably go away, are missing in the house. So often they are more worried about wrecking the house rather than they don't realize, they don't think that there are other things that could happen and sexual violence could happen. But because they trust their children and their friends. But then there are also great crashes who come in. And I suppose you can't avoid that. So, and also these trusted people can be sexual predators. And it's very hard to describe it to their parents what happened.
So in some ways, going back to kind of what the framework you were putting there is quite right.
Mm.
A lot of parents will, and families will allow parties to happen in their house, a lot of young people, when they go to university, are away from the family environment for the first time in rented accommodation.
Yes.
And to be clear, a lot of the young people who go to those parties, a lot of them, absolutely understand the advantages of, say, living away from home, for their parents being away from home for the weekend, and also understand that it is not a way of just sort of allowing mayhem to happen.
Yes.
So an awful lot of young people are brought up by their parents and by their educators to absolutely understand what is and is not proper respect for somebody else in a relationship.
Mm.
So many, many of these house parties that will have happened over the weekend are perfectly safe places because the young people at them understand themselves, respect for themselves, and respect for other people. However, the truth is, not everybody does. It is horrifying, Lakshmi, to see the number of people who are young adults, away from home possibly for the first time, certainly in a freer environment at third level, who know nothing about their emotional development, who don't actually understand that respect for themselves or respect for other people. And the real worry for us, in many ways, is that in these circumstances, some young people can do harm without meaning to do harm.
Yes.
And they can blight someone else's life and their own life forever simply through inadvertence. Okay, some people mean to do harm. Some people mean to be aggressive and assault. But other people simply don't have the mental framework and the emotional framework that they need to manage their own their own selves, their own emotional selves.
Yes, but how would you, I mean, the thing is, usually if, you know, young people, because they do date, I mean, throughout the...
Yes.
Yeah, and then they can gauge a person. And I suppose, you know, you kind of suss out, let's say, your dates, who is safe and who is not. But I wonder whether they have lost that... a kind of, you know, sixth sense also.
But I think, I mean, again, because we come across an awful lot of what I would call sound young people,
yes.
people who are really grounded, really understand what they're doing, I don't think young people have lost anything, really.
Yes.
They have the intelligence, but you have to develop that emotional intelligence.
Mm.
I think in some ways where people were getting married younger, where people were maybe only engaging in one or two relationships over the course of their lifetime, they in some ways had a better understanding, and they were nearly taught better that this is what they needed to know about themselves and about other people. And I'm talking girls and boys, men and women, here, that they were trained in some way into the kind of relationships that were expected. Life is much broader now, and young people have many, many more choices. And I think what has failed to keep up is our understanding of how to engage young people's emotional health and build that, so that by the time they're young adults, when they are dating, when they're just getting to know somebody or other, that they have this understanding of respect. It is true to say that many young people are going into third level. So you're talking young adults who know almost everything they know, either from talking to their friends or from the internet via pornography.
Yes.
You can't take the internet away. You can't take pornography away. But what we could and should do is ensure that people have a filter, have a way of critically understanding what they're seeing and hearing. We know that it's not really only about sexual relationships. We know the same issue arises where people are, their body image is distorted by what they see on the internet. So there's a whole lot of ways in which we should recognize that the amount and the waves and the torrents of information that come at young people is absolutely overwhelming them, and that they must be given the tools to critically analyze and decide what is and is not good. Young people will inevitably have to learn through experience, but to send them out into a world where we have permitted them access for maybe 10 years to unfiltered internet activity without giving them the counterbalances strikes me as really dangerous on the part of us and the older generations.
Lolene, do you think if children are more, you know, parents supervise them when they are small in the younger ages, and that they discuss more about it? If a parent supervises children, what they're doing with the internet and what they're watching, say when they are 8, 9, 10, 11, mm-hmm. there is a discussion between parents, and they know they are aware of what their children are at. But now, I suppose, you know, you can... Children, maybe the parents don't know much about the internet, but the children know more about the internet than the parents. So, inevitably.
Like a young chap said to me at one stage, he said, "You can't tell me about the internet. We're digital natives." In other words, we've grown up with the internet. Absolutely get that. That is true. Mm. And what I did say back, though, was that you might have more digital experience, but I had more life experience. Mm. And, you know, you can kind of marry the two. So undoubtedly, whether or not your child has a smartphone, one of your child's children or friends is likely to have a smartphone. And before, it used to be that a magazine was shared, and there was a real good chance that somebody would see the magazine and would give an opportunity for discussion. But what you said there, Lakshmi, is absolutely crucial, that parents can discuss it with their children. We know through the experience of our therapists and our counsellors on the helpline that some young people are going into young adulthood without ever having discussed these things with their parents, and without any work having been done on their emotional health in school. School is seen as the place where your intellectual health is looked after, and sometimes your physical health, but it's only on some occasions that emotional health is also looked after. And in a sense, you can see that school can't do it all, parents can't do it all, but just to recognize that one of the things we need our young people to be able to understand as teenagers, as adolescents, as young adults, as parents, as older people themselves, is they need to have an understanding of respect for themselves and respect for other people, so that they do not harass people sexually, they do not assault them sexually, they do not rape them, they do not subject them to child abuse. These are all things that our society has to take a deep breath and say, we have to address it, because the harm that sexual violence can do is enormous. It is normally invisible, but it can actually handicap a person for their entire lives.
Yes. I mean, the sexual act is not a relationship. It's an act. And very often it is separated from emotions and relationships. So I wonder,
but the person to whom, so somebody may very well say that's the way I saw it when I engaged in that sexual activity.
Yes, yes.
But for somebody else, it is terrible. An invasion, in a most intimate invasion of their person and of their soul. Mm. And in invading them like that, the harm that is done is,
yes,
all the studies show it to be more serious than the harm done by even a physical assault.
Exactly, because it's mental assault, really, and it stays with you for many years throughout your life, isn't it?
Like, I mean, yeah. Now people can move on from it as well. Just to be,
yes.
I mean, it's not all bad, you know.
No,
I mean, people definitely can experience it, can be hurt by it. and can heal as well.
Yes,
so like part of our job here in the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, I suppose, is to alert our society and those who make decisions about health and education to the need for to improve emotional health. But on the other hand, our other big job is to work with those who have experienced the harm of sexual violence and who are hurt by it. And we know for a fact as well that people can heal, can get on with their lives, and people's strength is enormous as well.
How do you encourage people to come more, you know, to your place, or to confide in a friend or so? How does one encourage it, I wonder?
Yeah, so I think the important thing about approaching the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, or indeed any rape crisis centre around the country, is that we will start our discussion and we will continue to be supportive and non-judgmental the whole way through. So anyone who phones the National 24-Hour Helpline at any time, day or night, is guaranteed to obtain a non-judgmental, supportive approach. And some people, it takes a lot for some people to say,
yes,
I was raped or sexually abused, or I am being sexually abused. It takes a lot.
Yes.
Sometimes people will phone maybe four or five times. They'll get a hello at the other end of the phone, but they won't be able to take it any further and they'll put down the phone. And then the day comes when they're able to say something. And anything that is said to us on the National 24-Hour Helpline goes no further than the person who hears it. It is confidential. We'll take some anonymous information. So, you know, because we need to be able to understand what we're dealing with. We'll take anonymous information. You won't have to give your name. You won't have to say where you're from. You won't even have to say what gender you are. Whatever it is you want to say, you will say. And we should be able to help people along their journey, because one of the senses we have is that for most people, naming it is a first step towards healing it. And so currently we have the helpline, we have email contact. We're looking at other ways of doing it as well. How could we otherwise help people in a safe, secure way? So we're constantly within our resources and looking for new funding to try and do things in different ways, to do more of what we do. Because while we can see a certain number of people in the Dublin Centre, and we have our centres in the main centres in Leeson Street, but we have our outposts in Coolock, in the Northside civic offices, and in Talla as well, and we're hoping to move to another outpost in the course of this year as well. So we like to think that people can be seen where it's comfortable for them and where it's easy for them, and where they can get the help they need in order to heal and in order to get on with their lives. No more than any other serious injury. It's not going to go away. We can't make it not happen. But hopefully through people's own work, they empower themselves to be better able to cope, to manage it, and to know that if there are, you know, if it's like, I sometimes think like a bad back, you know, you can heal a bad back as well, but you always might do a twist and something goes wrong, and we're here for people if they need to come back to us as well.
Has the Me Too movement influenced rape trials in Ireland? I just want to also ask you, the fact that you are a human rights lawyer, and what does the legal system say about?
Yeah.
Have there any changes?
Yeah, so there we hope there are changes coming. And again, the Me Too movement happened about a year and a half ago, although actually, in truth, and I need to keep reminding myself about this as well, the hashtag MeToo has been around for about 10 years.
Mm.
And it was used in a small community setting, again, for people who were victims of domestic and sexual violence to recognize each other. But it really took off in October 2017. And what I think that changed was people's capacity to disclose to anyone, to their family, to their friends, to our helpline, because it changed a certain feeling that people had, first of all, they realized they weren't the only ones,
yes,
that this happened to many other people. And the sense of isolation of sexual violence is huge. That was one thing. And the second thing was people could speak into an atmosphere where they felt they might be believed and understood. And that was a change as well. What has really brought about a possibility of real change in the justice system was the celebrity rape trial in Belfast,
yes,
this time last,
yes,
year, where you'll recall there were four men accused of rape, and or three of them accused of rape and other sexual abuse, and one of them accused of withholding information. There was a 9-week trial. It gripped the country,
yes,
in a very particular way. At the end of it, the men were acquitted. The jury found there was a reasonable doubt. The men were acquitted. But I think everybody's concerned, because there was huge division about who was right and who was wrong in that. And, of course, in a criminal trial, the question is there a reasonable doubt that the woman was consenting and that the men thought she was consenting? That's the question the jury had.
Yes.
But leaving that aside, there were two other issues of huge concern to the vast majority of the population. And one of them was about the WhatsApp messages that were taking place between the young men, who were some of the most privileged young men,
yes,
in our entire society in Ireland, after the events of that night. But the other thing was how awful the trial system,
absolutely,
was,
yes,
for every single person in it. Now, there are differences between trials in Northern Ireland and in the Republic of Ireland. So, for instance, in the Republic of Ireland, our trials are not held in public, and the names of the various parties aren't released until someone is convicted, and then only the name of the convicted person in some circumstances. But if you leave those two differences aside, there was very little difference in the cruel trial system,
yes,
north and south.
No,
so
I mean,
within...
I think we are coming to the end of our interview, because the time is up. But actually,
thank you.
Whatever happened, I remember the TD bringing a thong in to the parliament, to the door, and showing it off, you know. That was a good, I suppose, development, so that everybody sees
it. Was.
Yes.
It was as well, because it showed that consent had nothing to do with what you were wearing.
Exactly.
It had to do with,
exactly,
did you agree to the sexual activity?
Mm. Okay.
And currently that's all under review in our system right now.
And thank you, Nolene, coming and talking about this.
Lakshmi, I might just give you the number,
yes,
the 24-hour helpline number, because,
yes,
sometimes these are distressing interviews for people as well.
Absolutely.
Or someone might want more information.
I was going to say that afterwards. After the interview, I was going to say,
yeah,
that. Yeah. So
our number is 1-800-77-88-88.
Thank you, Nolene. Thank you very much.